then, it gives you a very good feel so that any outgassing from things on the International Space Station don't fog the window, and they're not going to be hit with these micrometeorites. It's a very fancy design, if you think about it, about that rotary shaft that goes through the wall. You've got the hydrocarbon. You've got normal atmospheric pressure for the astronaut on the inside, and you've got the hard vacuum of space on the outside. And you get this rotary shaft with two O-ring seals going through that wall. If those O-rings fail and you start leaking the air, they have to close the main door going to the cupola, and they have to seal it off from the rest of the space station because you can't tolerate leaks. Because your valuable oxygen goes into space and you can't get it back. You don't want very much of that to happen. So that was a very fancy design done by a mechanical engineer quite a few years ago. We kept all the original drawings, but there's a beautiful YouTube video that describes the design of that thing. You see it in operation, and they describe those O-ring seals. I think there are very few rotary shafts that go from inside the space station to outside the space station, with vacuum on one side and an air pressure on the other side. You gotta be careful with those. I wonder if you've seen that one, Paul. If not, I'll see if I can find it again and mail you that URL, WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I haven't seen it. Yeah, I'll watch that. I'll watch anything related to that, of course. And the cupola was sent up one of the later missions on STS-130, and they attached it to the... There's three nodes on the space station. You know, node one is Unity, node two is Harmony, and then node three is Tranquility. Right now, the cupola is attached to the Earth-facing side on Tranquility. And during the last couple of missions that went up, they would sometimes close those outer hatches to some degree. They didn't want thrust. You were worried about the thrust of the space shuttle, you know, affecting that. They didn't want to foul up their glass, so they would close it. But I mean, the idea of it was to really, you could watch all the incoming and departing flights on the American side. You can't watch the Russian side. Although it's at the bottom of it, you could see them coming up, but you know, you could really actually control the docking of some of the spacecraft and the cargo missions. They use the cupola. That's where they're at when they're controlling the Canada robot arm 2 attached to the space station when they're berthing the Dragon or Cygnus or the H-2 from Japan, you know, these cargo vessels. So it's kind of like a little, you know, tower that you would use at an airport.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
To that node, drop it. Now that node, they have done a lot of work in that. Last week, that now has a new cylinder attached to it, the multi-purpose module. And it was relocated from Node 2, from Unity, and they used a robotic arm on board, you know, just without the space, without the shuttle or anything. This was a couple of weeks ago, and they reattached this cylinder's 20-some-odd foot diameter, long thing, 14-foot diameter thing. over 20,000 pound contraption to one of the nodes just adjacent to the cupola. It's not blocking their view. They'll still be able to see the Earth and upcoming spacecraft. K2RIWWS2M.
In past conversations, Paul, I think you told us that the total International Space Station right now is close to 1 million pounds of hardware in end-to-end. I think it's considerably longer than a football field. So this is a very large object. And I have seen photographs of where somebody carefully timed a camera aimed at the sun as the International Space Station passes between them and the sun. And the International Space Station sweeps across the sun in roughly 1/3 of 1 second. 17,500 miles an hour, only half a degree of beamwidth of the sun. So it sweeps across in 1/3 of a second. You've got to have a very high speed movie, literally, of when you estimate the space station's going to cross the sun. And then hopefully one or two of those frames will catch the space station in the process of transiting the sun. Million pounds of hardware, and I think it's about a football field end to end. Is that approximately right, Paul? And by the way, I think the latest you told us is they're now sure they're going to keep using it up until the year 2022, something along those lines. WS2N, K2RAW.
Yeah, they're approved funding until 2024, and now the Russians have also approved it. I think toward the end of the last year, they approved it too. They were about to back out, but they're on board. And, it's the length of a football field plus the end zone. So, you're looking at, 320, 340 feet, something like that. That's all the truss pieces put together. I think there's 11 truss pieces in line. And then coming off the center of the truss pieces, you have the all your modules, series of modules. So, add it all up, the truss pieces, the 240-foot photovoltaic solar panels, all the different modules that are attached, roughly, I think it's around 10 or so. All these support platforms that are attached to it, series of them, all come out to about 1 million pounds. That I can remember. I can't remember the weight of the James Webb telescope, but I'll look that up for next week.
The photovoltaic cells are on a very large rotary joint, so as the International Space Station goes around the Earth, I believe they continue to aim toward the Earth. So there's a rotary joint with slip rings on each one of those. And I seem to remember 6 months or a year ago, one of those rotary joints was giving a lot of difficulty. I'm guessing that got replaced, got properly lubricated, whatever. Did that get fixed? To your knowledge, Paul, WS2N, K2RAW?
Yeah, that got fixed that's a couple of years ago. And I didn't know about the slip rings until actually John, KC2WGB, he came up with that. He found that it had slip rings. And then after that, I wound up researching it. Sure enough, it did. And that's the only way, it makes sense. It's the only way that you can really do it. And the... every time you go around the Earth, it revolves at that pace. And they, not only that, the panels, also translate in relation to the space station. They move, make sure they're facing toward the sun all the time. So they got plenty of power, In fact, when docking spacecraft come up, they'll be picking up power from that, from those panels. And that's why, you can get a Soyuz spacecraft and come up there. In the future, you're going to have the Dragon crew vehicles. And even the ones that come up now and stay for a month or two before they leave. They're all sucking the power off these panels. The space shuttle started doing that. The shuttle was able to actually have extended missions. They didn't have to use up their fuel cells. Like the earlier missions, so they would take the power from the solar panels and they'd stay an extra 3 or 4 days back there.
Now, not using their fuel cells implies that they turn off a fuel cell or at least turn it down. In the case of Apollo 13, I do remember that the design of the fuel cells of those days was such that if you turn it off, you can't turn it back on again. If it floods or something like that happens. I mean, don't use the fuel cells on the space shuttle, for instance, because you're using the power from the solar panels of the International Space Station. Maybe we've now got a more modern design of fuel cells that can be turned on and off with no difficulty. Do we know the total number of kilowatts that those solar panels, photovoltaics, that's a fancy word, do we know the total amount of kilowatts of power that they're creating on the International Space Station? Back to you, Paul, WS2N, TQIW.
Yeah, was it 80 per cell per panel? 80 kilowatts? I think something like that. I forgot. It's a huge number. Probably, I'll have to look it up. I seem to remember 80 kilowatts per panel, so probably 2,400 kilowatts total, something like that. Does that sound right, Dick?
That sounds the right ballpark. I think solar panels run, if I had to make a guess, I would say somewhere here, around 12% efficiency. We know the sun gives you something like 1,350 watts per square meter of raw solar input power. You know the approximate number of square meters, so we can calculate it, assuming they've got 12 or 15% efficiency. There have been supercells that have higher efficiency, but I don't think they're long-lived or fully developed or deployed in space yet. Anybody listening to our voices that have any further questions about space that you want to ask Paul, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. Now, one of the things you could do, now that you've got excess solar power on that space station, you could use it to run an ionic engine. And the ionic engine could now be doing station keeping, maintaining the altitude. The space station is always slowly sinking down. And when Progress or Space Shuttle or anybody else goes up there, they do a little bit of boosting. And so, with that excess power, they could be running an ionic engine. I think I told you one of the calculations I started doing one day, and I didn't finish it, is if you're putting a real good ionic engine on the moon, because assume that the tides stop doing what they're doing, by that I mean the interaction of tides on Earth and the moon is causing the moon to slowly spiral outward, something like an inch and a half greater altitude from the Earth each year. Inch and a half per year. Well, the moon's a pretty heavy object. So the total amount of thrust required to do that, if the tides stop doing it, is something that's calculatable. So it would be an interesting number. How strong an ionic engine would you have to install on the right-hand side of the moon, the western side, so to speak, so that it boosts it into a higher orbit at the same rate that the tides is doing it? Another one of my space puzzles was, if you're floating completely free inside the cargo hold of the space shuttle or in the International Space Station, you're floating completely free, but you want to change your orientation. You want to reverse your body head to foot or back to front. And you don't want to do something obscene. You're not taking anything away from your body. You're not throwing anything. But you want to do something to rotate your body head to toe or front to back. I wonder how many people can predict how to do that. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, and the astronauts and cosmonauts have two different ways that they do it.
Okay, Dick, let me go back to the ion engine. There's plans on doing it. In fact, they had plans, but they worked the engine a little bit more. But it's, they call it a Bessemer engine. It's an ion engine, a variable specific impulse magnetic plasma rocket. I mean, it's designed by a former shuttle astronaut, Chang Diaz. I've seen interviews with this guy. You know, he's no kid anymore. He did like, I don't know, four or five flights with NASA. He's retired now from NASA, but he's always been working on these rockets, these Vassar engines. And his goal was to, and he came close to it, right? I think they're still planning on doing it. They want to attach it to the space station for that reason, to cut back on the fuel necessary to bring up to keep that space station where it is, and a little higher orbit, and they don't want that orbit to decrease. So someday they will do that, and they'll have plenty of power from the solar panels. It's a much more powerful engine than what's on Dawn, the regular ion engine. A lot more powerful. Back to you, Dick.
So I think you're saying that that's under development. Anybody making a prediction as to how soon that might be deployed, then, Paul?
It should have been out last year. He's doing a lot of work with this thing. He's got his own company. Comes out of Costa Rica, this guy. He's American. But now he's got his... company is probably set up in Texas, and he's doing all this work on this thing, and he's been pushing the Vassar engine for forever. His goal, of course, is to, to attach it to a spacecraft to get to Mars quicker instead of, a 6 or 8 month journey, maybe cut it down to 3 months, that type of thing. That's the ultimate goal. But he's well respected. NASA loves this guy, and he's got a lot of proof behind his engine. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see it within a couple of years. Definitely before the 2024 date runs up. Back to you, Dick.
Sounds good. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer was put on the International Space Station a year or two ago, and the last I knew, it was measuring some extremely high power cosmic rays, direction of arrival, energy, and they were detecting a fair number of particles of antimatter. And so, and it too, no matter how potent a cosmic ray detecting you put in space, it's just a matter of time before a super particle comes along and saturates the damn thing. So, what's the strongest particle of a cosmic ray, or the strongest amount of energy you can get out of a cosmic ray? I don't think anybody knows. Figure the big number and the Mother Nature will supply something bigger for you. So it was detecting a significant number of antiparticles, negative matter. And I haven't heard much about that. I'm going to have to go look that one up, Paul. Maybe you have. WS2N, K2RIW.
And I was looking and found positrons, opposite thing of electrons, and that was some kind of signature that looking into the dark matter situation. So I bet that thing uses up a bunch of electricity. I'd like to see what kind of a load that thing has, but we'll have to see. You were talking about percentage of solar cells before. I jotted that down quick as a they wanted to let you know that the new ones that they have on Hubble are supposed to be 30% efficient. So even though they're a little bit smaller than the original ones, they're much more efficient than the original ones. And the power that thing needs, they don't need all that much power for Hubble, but they've come a long way upgrading that thing. That thing originally had a digital reel-to-reel tape on there for recording data before they sent it down. Of course, that's all been pulled out and upgraded. But the Hubble is still up and running with those good solar panels. 30% efficiency, I remember.
That's a nice number, 30% low. Yeah, the fact that Hubble used to have magnetic recording is not so hard to understand, because I think it was in the very beginning, a 1990 design. It got delayed a whole lot of years before it finally got launched. Or was it a 1985 design? Somewhere. You're going to tell me the exact year that Hubble was first launched. And we had that embarrassment of Mr. Magoo. He didn't focus. And along comes Stowe Musgrave and did a heroic operation to give it a set of spectacles. That's a very minor way of explaining what he did. He did a hell of a lot of work. And so, so Hubble has got the new 30% efficient solar cells. We don't know the efficiencies of the ones on the International Space Station. I guess it could be up there. Over you, Paul, K2RIW.
K2UPS has a comment, Nick.
I don't want to double with them. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, see what Richard's got to say. KKUPS. That's the one thing he doesn't do. I don't think he runs his QRP operation on solar panels, renewable energy. Well, maybe he has. KKUPS, probably in the middle of Pennsylvania by now. K2RIW, the TechNet. And when does your shift end tonight, Rich?
KJ4EOO.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I'm in Middle Pennsylvania, near Somerset, PA. KGPS mobile. I had just done a quick look on the solar panels. There's the eight different wings of solar panels. Each wing has over 33,000 individual cells, totaling about an acre of surface area between the eight wings, and it says that they produce between 75 and 90 kilowatts. So I think Paul had mentioned something about 80, which is right in that range that they quoted there, back to that. And I have yet to use solar power myself, some of my friends have, and I am going to be purchasing a small solar panel to keep my batteries topped off when I'm out, back to that.
So you're going to go solar. How about that? We just heard KJ4ELL, and if I got that correct, a person in Memphis. Go right ahead. Give us your name, sir, and go right ahead with your question or comment. KJ4ELL, I think it is. K2RIW.
Yeah, gentlemen, apologize for interrupting. Didn't realize it was a net. Name here is Jason, located in Warrenton, Virginia. I'm hearing the 147375 machine out of New York with the W2KPQ machine. Some great openings this evening. I'm located in Warrenton, Virginia. Not too far from Manassas. I'm keying up the 147375 machine with the 136CL. Anyway, just wanted to let you guys know that there's a decent opening and you're coming in loud and clear in Virginia. And again, I apologize for intruding to the net. Name here is Jason, KJ4 Echo Ocean Ocean.
Very good, Jason. So you're getting into the KPQ repeater, the 147375 by RF means. You may know that this repeater is linked with another machine, a 146.85. So there's a 146.85, same PL, and 147.375. I wonder, Jason, have you had a chance to listen to whether or not you're hearing us on 146.85? The two repeaters are about 30 miles apart, so there could be an opening to one that doesn't give you an opening to the other. Over to you, Jason, and do I have your call letters correct? Kilo Juliet 4, Echo Lima Lima, or maybe it's Echo Limo Oscar. Over to you, Jason, K2RIW, and the TechNet. My name is Dick. And maybe I shouldn't have tried to talk him going over to 146.85. Very possible one's coming through and not the other. So, how does the signal get that far? The refractive optics, or what is it called now? Forward propagated tropospheric scatter is one kind, or super refraction. When you get a layer of moist air close to the ground at nighttime from the dew, and drier air up high, moist air, because water has a dielectric constant of 8.1, the moist air, higher humidity air, has a higher dielectric constant with slightly lower velocity factor. So that gradient of humidity versus altitude, combined with temperature versus altitude, gives you a downward bending of the wave. And the so-called super refraction phenomenon is when that wave happens to be bent downward at the same rate as Earth curvature, in which case something like twice or so every year could be dropped. About twice every year around August, you get that condition between California and Hawaii on 2 meters. So guys will make direct RF contact across the 2,200 miles, California to Hawaii on 2 meters. Somewhere in late August or beginning of September, almost every year they get that super band opening. Propagation is a fun thing to study. And how in the world can that radio wave do that? In the case of 2 meters, if I had a small yeti on 2 meters on the chimney of my house, and I want to talk to a guy in central New Jersey with a small yeti on his house on 2 meters, on FM, yagi to yagi, no repeaters, most likely I would make it. With sideband, it would be gangbusters. So for the signal to go along the ground 50 or 100 miles, on 2 meters, rather easy for modern day equipment. Let me drop. You try doing the same thing on 40 meters, where you're inside the so-called skip distance, and you're probably not going to make it. So the next question is that 40 meter signal, that 7 megacycles, is it going from Long Island to New Jersey? The answer is absolutely yes. Is the signal strength similar to 2 meter signal? The answer is pretty close to yes. Okay, how come the guy in New Jersey and the guy in Long Island can't talk back and forth directly by ground wave on 40 meters? And the answer is noise. The signal is getting there, and the signal is going to be a microvolt, which is on 2 meters a pretty strong signal. Only you've got many microvolts of noise. The atmospheric noise on 40 meters is huge. It's equivalent to about a 35 or a 40 dB noise figure. So the signal is getting there, but the noise dominates. The only thing that can override that noise is a mirror-like reflection that you get from the ionosphere. So the bands that open, it's almost always the ionosphere that's doing it on HF. Not that your signal doesn't get there. Your signal is being overpowered by noise. That noise phenomenon is the reason, let me drop. That's the reason why you can take a random piece of wire, plug it into the SO239 connector on the back of your HF receiver, and get beautiful reception. Because that piece of wire probably has a standing wave ratio of 500 to 1. It's a really bad antenna. But two things are going on here. One, a receiver is very forgiving. Doesn't necessarily require a great match on the input. And the reason for that is the receiver has enough gain to listen to a weak signal. That small piece of wire is giving you a weak signal. But with the automatic gain control, it cranks itself up. It's got enough gain to do that. And because the signal-to-noise ratio, because you've got an antenna that's so bad, you're receiving less atmospheric noise, and you're receiving less amateur radio signal, but the ratio of the noise to signal stays about the same. The ratio of noise to signal is not a function of antenna efficiency. Antenna gain will make a difference, but small antennas, a dipole-like antenna, or small pieces of the wire, there's no real gain difference there, no real pattern difference. Let me drop. So that signal's getting there, but it's being overpowered by the noise that's also there. Almost every one of us have noticed that on various days, on HF with a good antenna, the S meter reads quite a bit above S0. There are times when the noise gets as high as S9, atmospheric noise. That's a huge amount of signal. An S9 signal is 50 microvolts. A good 2-meter receiver in the sideband mode can easily listen to 0.02 microvolts. And yet on HF frequencies, you can get a signal as strong as 50 microvolts. What's the ratio between those two? Let me think about that. 0.02 microvolts. So 50 to 1, 50, the 2,500 to 1 ratio in voltage. You square that to figure out the power difference. It's probably 10 million to 1. So there's a 70 decibel difference between the noise power coming into your receiver on some HF frequencies, some days, versus the noise power that comes into your receiver on, the, say, 2 meters or 432. Crazy stuff. So not many launches are going to take place for a while. When do the launches speed up again, then, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
There's a lot of launches, you know. I mean, Russia's got a whole bunch of them. Even India has one coming up. But as far as we're concerned, the next American launch would be SpaceX Falcon 9, end of July. And then a couple of months after that, you'll have another Falcon rocket with the beam on board. That's going to be the inflatable module that's going to be attached to the International Space Station. SpaceX is also going to bring that up. So roughly every couple of months for the SpaceX. And then CRS-9, that's another cargo flight. So next one coming up is 7, the beam will be 8. 9 will be another docking mechanism. So you'll have one docking mechanism going up next month, the end of next month. The beam inflatable one, a couple of months after that, you're going to have another docking module, docking adapter that's going to be attached to the other pressure mating adapter that's going to be relocated on the space station. So now in the fall, then you're going to have, see, SpaceX has a lot of launches, and you're going to have the test of the Falcon 9 Heavy. That's going to be 3 Falcon 9s bolted together, launched from California as a test. That's going to be the Heavy launch vehicle. So that's Falcon. That's the Falcon flights coming up.
I want to see the baby pictures of Pluto.
Yeah, you're coming up. That's July 14th, John.
Very good. Can't wait.
Before, you know, they're taking pictures now.
Have they made a prediction, Paul, as to roughly how many close-up pictures they'll get during that flyby? And I presume it's also carefully timed to also look at some of the satellites of Pluto. And I think Pluto has got, what, about 5 moons? Go ahead.
It does have 5 moons, and they might discover, you know, one or two smaller ones as they go by. But, you're going to have pictures of Charon, of course. That moon is, I think, roughly half the size of Pluto. So that's a big one. That was only discovered, what, in the 1970s or something. And then you've got the four other moons, the smaller ones. They're interested in that, but I think they're really interested in naturally, what, of course, what Pluto looks like. And this thing's going to be whipping by at like 30,000 miles an hour, Dick. So I hope they got fast cameras. There's not only cameras, there's equipment on board. There's other instruments that are going to be doing tests. They'll be able to tell what the atmosphere is made of and all of that.
Comment. John, recognize 30,000 miles an hour is the speed that it's going to be swishing by Pluto. At first, it sounds like it's too fast, and you're only going to get a tiny little look. Well, the International Space Station is going around the Earth at 17,500 miles an hour, a little more than half that speed. It takes 90 minutes to make one orbit. So we're going to get a reasonable number of pictures as I see it. Now, you call them, John, baby pictures of Pluto. What made you say baby pictures? KC2WGB, KQRIW.
KC2WGB. Well, I think that this is going to be the best photos we're ever going to see of Mars, of Pluto. And it's sort of like baby pictures, you know. We're great expectations. But I think, you know, with all the money we're spending and all the trouble we're in, it would be very nice if JPL or whoever's in charge of the photographic mission should do a nice little salute to, like, the Marines and stencil in with Photoshop, Kilroy was here, just to get people talking. Maybe they'd notice the space program. Back to you, Dave.
Yeah, I'm reasonably sure they're not going to do that. You might know this one, Paul. You and I could easily look it up. I'll bet you've got it in the back of your head. What's the approximate diameter of Pluto compared to the Earth's moon? My guess is Pluto is smaller than the Earth's moon. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, we thought it was about half. Chairman, is the moon around Pluto is 700 miles away. I think Pluto is 1,300 miles. Something along those lines. So I think that's the best way I can remember it. So, you know, there's so many other objects out there, too, that are similar to Pluto. And that's why someday I think they're going to have to bring Pluto back into the fold of a planet. You know, you've got, you know, naturally Jupiter's our biggest planet, but we go down to Earth size, Venus size, Mars is smaller, Mercury is even smaller. Mercury is, what, 1,500 miles? I remember that from the message of light. And then Pluto is like, I think Pluto's around 800 miles in diameter. So that puts Charon at probably maybe 400 or 500 miles in diameter. But you've got these other planets out there. I call them planets, but you know, similar to Pluto. One called Makemake, that's 440 miles in diameter. Sedna, I remember when they discovered that thing, that was like 300 miles in diameter. And these things all revolve around the sun. So, I don't know, someday I think they're going to reverse this.
You've got a good memory. Pluto is 1,471 miles in diameter, according to the Google search I just went to. Moon is 2,600 miles in diameter. So it's very close to 2 to 1, just like you said. So Pluto, roughly half the diameter of our Earth's moon. And what was your estimation for the diameter of Mercury? Mercury is also pretty small, isn't it? Back to you, Paul.
I seem to remember it was around 1,500 miles. You know, I remember one time they said it's half the distance across the United States. Well, the United States, I always think it's 3,000 miles. So that's how I got this thing put to my memory bank.
I just looked up Google. Mercury is 3,032 miles in diameter. So roughly a 2-to-1 ratio between Mercury and Pluto, and close to a 2-to-1 ratio between Earth. Turns out Earth's moon is just a tiny bit smaller in diameter than Mercury. Ain't that crazy? Mercury is a planet, and our moon is a satellite. But our moon is bigger than Pluto, just a tiny bit smaller than Mercury. And so, this certainly is a significant controversy. I think the main reason why they wanted to make Pluto a non-planet is because in that Kuiper belt, or the Oort cloud, I think it's the Kuiper belt, they're discovering a number of objects bigger than Pluto. So if you kept gathering all of the planets as you discovered them in the Kuiper belt, we pretty soon have 18 planets in our definition going around the sun. Let me drop that. And so the usual memory schemes by which we for years and years have been memorizing the nine planets. We now had to memorize 18 of them. and some of them are so far out there with such extremely long orbital periods. I don't know what the orbital period of Pluto is, but if somebody told me it's a 250 years, I believe it. In fact, there's a way, by way of that harmonic law, knowing that it's Pluto is 39 astronomical units, roughly. I can easily calculate it. I think it's like 250 years for one orbit around the Sun. Can you imagine an object that you discover at two or three times the distance of Pluto in the Kuiper Belt? We're talking about 1,000 years orbit of the Sun. We ain't going to live for very many of those, though, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
No, there ain't enough vitamins in Ron Cockman. We need the aliens to come down and then, you know, give everybody a shot, and then we'll come back. And I'm going to tell you about 1,000 years, you know, we'll have to live for 1,000 years before we see that autopsy clock ring around the Earth, you know. Some of these other ideas that the, it sounds feasible, but to be put into practice, I think you're going to have to, you know, wait a couple of 1,000 years. I think you're going to have to wait a couple of 100 years just to even see one elevator to space. You know, you might see that type of thing coming off the moon or something, but not off Earth.
I just looked it up. Pluto takes 248 years, 247.6, let's call it 248 years to make one orbit around the Sun. So those other things we've discovered quite a bit further out. You're going to rapidly approach 1,000 years for orbital period. So it's not easy to call that a planet in the normal sense when the period of rotation, the period of orbit, is that long. However, here we are with Voyager, what, three times the distance of Pluto. If Voyager was out there in orbit around the Sun, we're talking about many thousands of years for an orbit. However, I've been saying for a long time, when you launch a radio signal, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. Depending on your antenna pattern, in certain directions it's going to be a hell of a lot weaker than other directions. But every antenna radiates some amount of signal in every single direction. We call it a null. In other words, if the antenna pattern has a lack of signal by 30 dB in some direction, we call it a 30 dB null, and we make believe that no signal goes in that direction. Well, the signal in that direction is 1,000 times weaker than some other direction, but it's not zero. It never goes to zero. So the fact that a signal from three times the distance of Pluto comes down here from Voyager, and we read it, pretty strong evidence that signal goes everywhere. Can't stop it from doing that. There are lots and lots of people who I used to talk to who told me that when a signal goes that far, there's something more than just free space loss. It's going to get tired. Let me drop it. If it had to go through a real dense cloud of dust, maybe you're going to get some attenuation. Even that's difficult to. Radio signals go through clouds very nicely. That's the whole reason for the James Webb Space Telescope being an infrared telescope. It's going to look through the dust clouds to see what's going on in the nurseries where the stars are forming right now. But a star is starting to form. It's really a great big dust cloud that's starting to coalesce. So to watch the forming process, to watch the star suddenly come to a birth and suddenly light up, I think there's a good chance that the James Webb Space Telescope, as long as it goes into space with no major glitches and it really does get deployed and starts working, you're going to see some of that jazz. An infrared signal goes through those dust clouds. Well, radio signal goes through a dust cloud even better. Has almost no attenuation. So the people who used to try to convince me that radio signal at long distance is going to get tired, absolutely not. That radio signal is just a lower frequency than a light signal. And that light signal, you can see, in theory, you can see a light signal from 13.7 billion light years away. It doesn't get tired. It gets weaker and weaker by the inverse square law, but it's always there. That's the magic of electromagnetic radiation. It goes everywhere. All you got to do is build the right kind of equipment, and you can receive it from anywhere. time we have a great big radio telescope in Ronkonkoma, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I mean, it's where I want. What question for you, Dick?
Yeah. Paul first on that one, and then we're going to go over to Joe. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, that's not going to happen, but we'll look for future things to be built in Ronkonkoma, including that antenna tower. That thing hasn't been put up yet, by the way, Dick. Thought I'd just mention that. We talked about that on the net a couple of nets ago. And it's still on the ground. Well, not on the ground. It's been nothing being done. I know Joe wanted to say something back to you there.
Yeah, it turns out that Paul is referring to the T-Mobile proposal to put up a 130-foot high pole in a particular town, a particular area of Ronkonkoma, outside of Paul's area, but it's the same town, for cell sites, better reception. And the neighbors have been fighting it for a couple of years, but I think they're going to lose that battle. The town has already approved that construction. Joe, W2RYY, you got one of these long-range radio questions? Let's hear it. You got it, Joe.
Yes, as a matter of fact, they do. They exactly have that kind of question. You must have read my mind. Amazing. With the current technology that we have, and knowing the technology we installed on Voyager, and how that receiving apparatus receives, how long would you estimate people on this planet will be able to communicate with that device before communications is no longer possible? Where, you know, I mean, total tap. You can send it, but you get nothing back. How long do you estimate that's going to be? In years, maybe.
I think Paul told us that they're proposing to listen to Voyager to something like the year 2022 or 2024. It's going to get weaker as the distance gets greater by a very predictable rate. However, we're always increasing the sensitivity of our radio telescopes. We're always increasing the diameter of our radio telescopes. They haven't done it yet, but the great big telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia, the one that is 1,000 feet, let me think that. It's 100 meters. 100 meters, that it's 300, roughly 330 feet in diameter. That's a lot bigger than the Goldstone dish. They haven't used that one yet, but they could. So when it comes to listening to a weaker and weaker signal, you just need a bigger and bigger radio telescope. And the radio telescope you listen to it with doesn't have to be one co-located object. By way of very long baseline interferometry, you could gather the signal on 3, 4, or 5 radio telescopes simultaneously, and if you're smart enough, you combine the signal from those radio telescopes, doing it with tape recordings. You're not doing it in live. I mean, if some of those radio telescopes are 5,000 miles apart, you're not running a 5,000 mile long coaxial cable between the two. Let me drop. So, to get enough receiving area with enough receiving sensitivity by way of long baseline interferometry, we got a long way to go, Joe. I'll bet you we can come up with 10, 15 dB more sensitivity than we've used now on receiving. That spacecraft is going to be that poor cathode on that poor traveling wave tube on that transmitter will be all out of, it's going to use up all of its electrons, it's going to use up all of its coating long before we can stop listening to it. And when it comes to transmitting a strong enough signal to it so that it can hear you, you can always come up with a more powerful transmitter. And in theory, you can also use very long baseline interferometry, combined radio telescopes, as a phased array to do the transmitting. By way of global positioning satellite receivers, disciplining those oscillators, making them all on the exact same frequency, on the exact same phase, there's nothing stopping you from using very long baseline interferometry for the transmitter. You're getting an idea here, Joe, about as long as you can get these individual organizations to dedicate their hardware, we got a long way to go yet. We're not going to run out of range on Voyager. WHYYY,
You're worrying unnecessarily, Joe. The major RY line, can't you ride on it?
Nothing to worry unnecessarily. I'm just, you know, just asking a question just in general because the technology you have on Voyager was built, you know, what, 35, 40 something years ago, give or take. It can only receive down to such a noise level and do so many things. It has a finite capability within itself.
Yeah, I think you're right on this one, Joe. When it comes to listening to Voyager, what's going to fail first, uplink or the downlink? My rough guess is the uplink is going to fail first, because it's probably a fairly simple diode front-end receiver. I'm having trouble believing that got an extremely low noise preamplifier in Voyager. Voyager, I think, was built 1977, so that makes it a 38-year-old technology in that order. And I guarantee it didn't have a super low noise preamp, because if it did and it failed, you're dead in the water. You're better off with a crystal diode front end, which is, I think, what they did. And just make sure you got enough uplink power to overload that receiver front end. So I think the uplink might fail before the downlink. But then again, you build a powerful enough transmitter, and I think it's going to hear you. And the downlink, up till now, I've been telling you about combining various radio telescopes to receive more and more of that weak signal on the downlink. Let me drop it. You've got another capability. Because the system does not have a local oscillator on board that's drifting and squittering and everything else, the way the whole deep space network works, that it literally counts every cycle of what you send up to it. You could say it drops some of those cycles in order to shift the frequency of what comes back down. So there's the exact ratio is 240 over 221. That's the uplink frequency versus downlink frequency, 240 over 221. So you can literally count every cycle that's coming back down because it's related to every single cycle that you sent up. So it's got beautiful frequency accuracy. You're determining the frequency accuracy. Therefore, there's nothing stopping you from using a more and more narrow phase lock loop receiver on the downlink. Right now, I think they're running downlink at 50 bits per second. If you want to get twice the sensitivity, you half the bandwidth of the receiver, and you transmit the data at 25 bits per second. That gives you twice the sensitivity. You do that again, so you get four times the sensitivity, and now you've got twice the range of the downlink. Let's see now. If I divide 4 into 50, that's roughly 12. If I go down to 12 bits per second of data rate, in theory, the downlink has four times the sensitivity dBs, 6 dB, therefore twice the range. I can double the range of the downlink with the current equipment, but just by slowing down the data rate and using a more narrow phase lock loop receiver, you're really getting into integration techniques. So where do you call it integration? Where do you call it narrow bandwidth? That's a matter of semantics. You got all kinds of ways of getting of skinning this particular cat, Joe. The V2RYY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen, but it's just interesting that something they built from so long ago, because they built something nowadays, it still works, and will probably continue to work for a long time.
I believe there were two transmitters on board, and I think they're using the backup transmitter right now. I think the first transmitter or receiver, one or the other, it did fail. Isn't that true from your memory, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
No, I don't think they failed. I remember you got two Voyagers here, and last I heard they were both working. They had two, each one had two traveling wave tubes. So does that mean they had two transmitters? I don't know. But I know, 2022 was what they were thinking about, and then recently I read 2024. And don't forget, they never thought they'd get this far, because the equipment that they listened to, it wasn't as sensitive back in 1977, so that number already has been extended. So maybe we'll hear it even beyond that, hopefully. 100 and
60 bits per second, and I think that was 2 years ago, Jake, so that's hopeful.
Okay, you got the real number, 160. I was estimating 50. So we got a little more sensitivity than I thought, therefore can use a little bit higher data rate. And so the nice thing about Voyager, it's out there making measurements as to what the cosmic ray rate, micrometeorite particle rate, the solar flux, in other words, the solar wind. I think we've already confirmed that we've gone beyond the distance of the solar wind. The solar wind is going out there at a million miles an hour in our neighborhood. But as it gets out to the perimeter of our solar system, that solar wind slows down, and eventually it becomes overtaken by the so-called galactic wind. It's now out of the solar system into the galaxy. I think we've already crossed that threshold, and then now we're looking at the direction. The solar wind is sort of looped back toward the sun, and now they're measuring a galactic wind. Is my memory on this one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Oh yeah, and on the their website, they always show you at Voyager 1. You can tell they have inside. It's like green, and the outside is orange, you know, and how many parts per million or whatever it is. And they showed up on Voyager 2 as well. Well, Voyager 2, it's off the chart, you know, that one's gone. You've got a long way to go with that. But Voyager 1, they have the green, it's very small, and the orange is very large, which means, you know, at one time, the green on Voyager 1 was larger than the orange on this chart, you know. Each one has to do with the solar wind. It also has to do with the angle. They can tell the angle that it's coming in from. If it's coming from the sun, it's going one way, and then when the solar wind starts coming from another direction, they know that's outside the solar system. So they're waiting for eventually Voyager 2 to happen to that as well. Right now, that, you know, it's still quite a ways to go on that. Come back in a couple of years, and you'll see the green will be decreased down to a low number, and then this orange line will be higher. Back you, Dick.
And we've just about run out of time. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1559 of the series that began in September of 1982. 32 and three quarter years ago. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. We'll settle some of these issues. And over to you for any other closing comments, John. KC2WJV, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
KC2WJV. Yes, I'd like to thank everybody for joining and participating. And all goes well. We'll do it again this coming Sunday. So enjoy. Be happy out there. This is a hobby, KC2WJV.
Yeah, don't take it too serious. You're not going to get out of this one alive. You better enjoy the process. And one of the things that I've said a few times, a man is usually not much bigger than the thing that makes him angry. Anybody can get angry. Look at the bigger picture. Bye-bye, you all. See you later.
That's right. Never get angry. Get even.
Be kind to each other.